British Australian Alessio. Stayed with them for about 5 years. Yes. No. I've gone up there to try cases, and I've gone up there to work matters with lawyers.
How does Anchorage compare to Fairbanks?
Well, the biggest thing about Anchorage is that, number one, the weather is a lot better, and that helps from the point of view of a woman and a family. Secondly, you do have the advantages of being able to go to a lot of other places. Homer, for example, you know, Seward, Girdwood, those are readily available for enjoyment. And we like the arts, we like performing arts, we like the plays here. Those are have an advantage. I find the people here the same as Fairbanks. The big one, the drawback here is that the city is getting large. There is a little bit of a, I have a little bit of a concern about some of the things I've seen develop in the bar. I'm not very much of an advocate of, I think some of Will Condon's associates, I think that some of them have misused their powers, and I object to it. On the other hand, Dan Hickey, I resent. I think he's a danger. I think Larry Weeks, he's left. I was not impressed with Larry Weeks. On the other hand, I think there's some fine young attorneys in that. Bob Bundy is one of the outstanding prosecutors, I think, very highly of Bundy. He's a professional. And there are some others like that. But I'm a critic of some of the things I've seen in the Attorney General's office, and I'm never thought I'd get to the point maybe where I might want to see an elective office, but I'm beginning to wonder. I think we have a good array of attorneys in this community, a lot of good young attorneys, and a lot of other attorneys a little older that are good attorneys. I think there's a little bit of dog-eat-dog that bothers me, you know. It's become a practice, sue the lawyer, and lawyers are suing the lawyers. And I guess you have to do that if that's really the matter. But it seems it's happening a little quicker than, a lot of times without reason. And that bothers me. So I enjoy the profession because I'm in with two young men, and we have a great practice of law in the sense that we enjoy each other. We're small. We can take off periodically when we want to. And that makes for it. Most of the people with whom we have legal battles, as far as we're concerned, they're able, capable counsel. I don't know, there's a different flavor. Parrish and I could fight. Warren Taylor and I, all of us, could battle and be mad at you. Charlie Cole. I remember Charlie getting so mad at me one time after a case. But just a little while later, we were laughing and we were friends again. Now, bitterness seems to hold more. And other attorneys and judges have told me that, too. They said, in fact, one judge was telling me the other day that he was surprised. Judge Rowland. Mark Rowland. Mark was telling me he was surprised that a lot of the lawyers in the courtroom seemed to be biting each other a little harder, taking longer times. I don't know if he wants me to quote him, but that's, and I understand it. I've seen it a bit.
What about the kinds of people that are practicing? Have they changed? Have you seen a different kind of lawyer?
You know, I went to skiing about 2 weeks ago. My wife, and I said to her, as we went upstairs to the lodge and looked around, I said, same people, new faces. I'm not sure I'd say that with all the lawyers. There's a lot of them that are same people, new faces. And a lot of them are just chipped off the old blocks. R.J. Smith, we subleased to out here. Got involved with him in a case, and I was so impressed with him. You know, became friends. And I've seen that. I've seen Van Doren. I've seen young Buckaloo. I've seen just a lot of young attorneys. It really impressed me as being good attorneys. And some of the old attorneys are still delightful to work with, you know. Now Delaney and George Hayes, I love to work with those guys. I respect them. But I can tell you there's a couple, three out there that I'm lying in wait. And when I get them, I'm going to get them good. Most of the people in the Eli Guest office are very, very nice young people. Delaney's office, I highly respect. Hughes Thostis has some nice people. There are some in there that I'll do battle with. I think highly of Biss and Holmes. I think they're very good attorneys. There are a lot of good ones. I won't offend those that I don't think are good attorneys, but there are a lot out there that are not good attorneys too. They're a different breed, and I think they may change. Sometimes it takes a little bit of that time. I will mention, as I say, Don Hickey. I have no problem mentioning because I think Hickey's a very dangerous man in his slot. I don't think he knows how to handle the power. You know, I think I saw him hurt Ed Murdy's. I saw him hurt. Ed Dankworth. I don't think it's hard to take a public figure and get the newspapers behind you and to prosecute them or go after them, you know. Holman, you know, if it's a case of who you're going to believe, if it gets down to who do you believe, the public figure or the other fella, more times than not, they're not going to believe the public figure. So you have to be careful when you go after a public figure. If they're guilty of some wrong, go after them. But have something that's fairly tied down, and that's the thing that I think concerns me sometimes.
Many of the lawyers were involved in politics in the early years, and you see many fewer involved in politics now. You didn't get very involved in politics either. Can you give any reasons for the trend and for why you yourself?
Well, I didn't get involved in politics because the one time I was involved in politics, it sort of left a sour taste in my mouth. I didn't like the time I was putting in to the detriment of my family. I didn't like, I tell the story about the lady that called me up about 5 a.m. one morning and told me that her driveway was blocked with snow and her husband couldn't get out. And I said, well, it's 5 a.m. It's, you know, I'm on the city council. I'm not a full-time employee with the city. She says, but you're on the public works department. You can tell those fellows. And I said, oh, my God, you know what time it is? You know, I have a busy day. And she says, well, that's the problems of being a council member. So about a week or 10 days later, I came back home from an outing about 1 a.m. And I called her up at 1 a.m. And I said, how are they doing with that snow plow? And she was furious with me. And I said, now, come on, where's your sense of humor? You woke me up the other morning at 5 a.m. But I knew that politics wasn't my bag. And I think a reason why a lot of lawyers are not in politics today is because of the disclosure law. And I think that was an anti-attorney provision, you know, where you have to tell who all your clients are. I don't care about telling who my clients are, but a lot of time the clients don't want you to tell who they represent. I represent one fellow who's very concerned about a partnership relationship he has. Well, do I reveal his name to the public? And his partner's alive will look at that and say, what are you going to see Henry Campbell for? I represent a judge right now in a matter that's gotten a little public notoriety. Well, maybe he might not want to tell people. He's conferring with, he doesn't care in this instance. So that, I think, keeps a lot of lawyers from running. Others don't seem to care.
Is there anything you'd like to say just about the practice in Alaska?
Great. It's great. I love it. I love the juries. I think we got a, with probably one exception, in all of Alaska, I think we have some fairly astute and capable lawyers as judges. I think they're good. One exception bothers me a bit is one judge that I'm not too too sure about yet. I want to watch that situation. I've been watching it for some time now. I'm not sure about Vic Carlson. Well, I think he's too oriented to the state. He's too oriented to the prosecution. And that's what's happening at this very moment with Dana Fabe and that Meech case. So I'll give him the benefit because I haven't had that much in front of him. But what I did have, the state always prevailed. And it's not the way it should be. I also resent a judge taking part in litigation. Now, I realize there's a big philosophical difference here. But if I'm working hard on my case, and I put all the books out, and I go at it, and the other fellow doesn't do a thing, and we go to trial, and all of a sudden, the judge is working with him and asking questions that he should be asking, you know, doing things that makes him almost an advocate. And I had this out with Jay Rabinowitz once when he was a Superior Court judge. I resent and I object to you asking the questions of the witness. If you want to be an advocate, please take off your robe, come on down here and be the lawyer, and let's get a different judge. And I see Carlson doing a little of that. It worries me a bit. But anyhow, I haven't had that much with him, so I don't have to worry.
Straightforward area. It sets out in the statute, usually one or both parties are represented by attorneys occasionally, but not very often, neither is. A complaint is filed and served, an answer is filed and served, and it proceeds as any other civil litigation. With one caveat, there cannot be a final hearing in less than 30 days after the filing of the complaint, unless some kind of good cause can be shown. I've never heard of anybody having a hearing in less than 30 days because it's impossible as a rule to get onto the calendar that quickly. But I suppose it's probably been done. As far as dissolutions are concerned, or as clients call them, I think it's a great word, disillusionment. A couple can, on their own, without an attorney, petition the court for a dissolution of their marriage if they meet the conditions that are set out here in your outline. They have to have an incompatibility of temperament. They have to have agreed on child custody, child support, visitation, spousal support, who's going to get the income tax refund, all of these kinds of things. They have to have either divided up all of their jointly owned property or agreed on how they're going to divide it. And they have to agree as to who is going to be responsible for all the debts. Everything has to be agreed upon and nothing can be ignored. And if they can agree on all of that, they can pay the $50 filing fee, fill out the forms, go to the hearing, and get divorced. I one day sat in the master's room waiting for a case of mine to be called, and there was a young man in there. He was just by himself, and he went through a long list of property, real property, personal property, child support, and he kept assuring the master that everything had been agreed upon, and then finally they got to the washing machine. And he said, could you help me with this? We cannot agree on who should have the washing machine. And the court said to him, I cannot help you, and I'll have to deny your petition if you won't make up your mind that your wife will have it at this point. And so he didn't get his petition for dissolution granted that day. So, and that happens not infrequently. I don't know whether it's the fault of the form that the court gives the people. The mediation method of getting a divorce is a real interesting idea. I've never seen it work in practice, although I think it could be good. It's basically a remedy that's available within the formal divorce procedure. And the statute says any time within 30 days after the complaint or the cross-complaint has been filed in a divorce action, either party can file a motion requesting the court appoint a mediator and try to get the parties together to achieve a settlement. Or the court can, on its own, appoint a mediator and order the parties to submit to, I think, one or two sessions of mediation. I think that this was once used when they had a real shortage of judges, and they pulled in some practicing attorneys to act as mediators to try to catch up on a backlog of divorce cases. But as far as I know, it's not very widely used today. The one time I requested it, the judge denied my request. So I thought it was giving him a way out of doing some work, but he denied it anyway. It certainly could have some potential, but largely ignored. There are a few statutes within this area that are largely ignored. This is one, and another one we'll come to a little later concerns the penalty for obstructing visitation, which is gives the person who's been denied visitation a cause of action for damages. And that's another one. It's not used very much. Okay, and then there's another form of dissolution, which is one spouse can petition the court for dissolution of the marriage. Again, if there's an incompatibility, and if they can't find their other spouse, and they don't know what their feelings are about the division of property, and they can't serve them within the state of Alaska. And that, again, is another do-it-yourself procedure. Okay, the section that starts on the sixth page of your outline on grounds for divorce is interesting. I suppose you should be familiar with it, and we'll go through it quickly, but I really don't think that it's likely to come up on an exam question. It might.
Is this for just divorce, or is this also for dissolution?
No, in dissolution, the only grounds are incompatibility of temperament, so severe as, of course, breakdown of the marriage.
Procedures laid out two or three, or two do-it-yourself procedures, but there is a third lawyer-assisted dissolution procedure.
No, there's a lawyer, the regular divorce procedure for which most people have lawyers. And then there's the two dissolution procedures, the one when both people are doing it and the one when one person is absent. And practically speaking, all divorce actions, or almost all divorce actions, take place on the basis of incompatibility of temperament, which is part of the whole statute detailing all of the grounds for divorce. However, there are these other grounds, and I guess you should know that adultery, conviction of a felony, willful desertion for a period of 1 year, cruel and inhuman treatment, habitual gross drunkenness, there's a couple of others, mental illness, drug addiction, are all grounds for divorce. I really think that about 99% of divorces in Alaska are filed on the basis of incompatibility, mainly because, at least as far as lawyers are concerned, they don't want to get into the proof problems connected with these kinds of grounds. Sometimes clients are. You know, that it isn't uncommon to have a client say, I don't care if you think we're incompatible. He's been adulterous, and I want the complaint to say that we're suing on the basis of adultery. And then you have to argue with your client a little bit about how that's maybe not the wisest thing to do. Incompatibility of temperament has been a ground for divorce in Alaska for a long time, since 1906, I think. And so that makes us one of the first states to have no-fault divorce. Most states now have it, but many have had it just in recent years. There really aren't any Supreme Court cases on incompatibility of temperament. Basically, if one party denies that there is an incompatibility and the other party maintains that there is an incompatibility, the court is going to find that there's an incompatibility. Some people have suggested that infidelity is a defense to incompatibility. I don't think that that one would get really very far arguing that. I once had somebody argue that or assert that as a defense in a case that I filed, and I moved to strike the defense, and the court struck it. So I don't know why they did, but they did. So I don't think that that's going to get people very far. As far as these things like drunkenness and drug addiction are concerned, they have to have occurred after the marriage. I really don't think that you're going to get a question in this area, but you might. They have to have occurred after the marriage. So if you married a drug addict or you married a drunkard, it's tough luck. You can't get out of the marriage on the basis of the part of the statute that says that that's a grounds for divorce. Of course, you can always divorce them on the basis of incompatibility. The one section that talks about incurable mental illness, it's important to note that if that is being asserted as a ground for divorce, it doesn't relieve the spouse who's alleging that from his or her obligation to pay spousal support or cares of being in the costs of being in an institution and things like that. So I think read through that section and read through the section on the defenses. The defenses are, I think, even more archaic, but again, it could come up if the person who's writing the question is short of things to examine you on. Procurement means basically that the person participated. Connivance means that they agreed. Condonation means the act has been forgiven by voluntary cohabitation, and that's usually a defense to adultery or conviction of a felony. And just failing to commence the action will is a defense. That's kind of an equitable latches type of defense, I think. So these cases that are cited on the seventh page of your outline, Day versus Day and Romig versus Romig, you should read over that section, but basically all it does is give you the definition of incompatibility, and I don't think that there's anything much that I can add there. The next section of your outline deals with...
One quick question. The only time you need the 6 months within the last 6 years is for a regular divorce, but not for the dissolution at all. That just is residency or domicile. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, to a certain extent, right. Mm-hmm. For the dissolution, you have to have either both parties here and then, yes, you would have had to have had the children here for 6 months prior to the commencement of the action, but that's not under the long-arm statute. That's under the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, which we'll get to a bit later. The 6 years, the previous 6 months, 6 months out of the previous 6 years is what you have to have when you're trying to serve somebody who's out of state. Under the long-arm statute, they have to have had that much contact with the state for there to be jurisdiction. So you don't have that situation arise in the dissolution context because you've got to either both be here and be agreeing, or the other kind of dissolution proceeding where you can't find the other person.
In the dissolution setting, do you have to serve by publication, or do you just give no notice and go in and say you don't know when the spouse is?
I don't know for sure because I don't ever do them, but I don't think you have to serve by publication. I think you just go in and say you don't know where they are, and you might have to fill out an affidavit and fill out an inquiry or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure that you don't have to serve by publication.
Where you can't find the other spouse,
mm-hmm.
But you've got property and children in state.
Mm-hmm.
Your court will only make you one.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But basically, you don't have much of an alternative in that situation. Okay, the next section is on the kinds of relief you can get during the pendency of the action. This is usually an area where there's a lot of litigation in divorces, and the statute is 955-200, and it says that the court in the interim period can provide for interim spousal support, interim child support, for one party to pay the other party's attorney's fees, for one party to pay the other party's accountant's fees, for one party to move out of the house, one party to have interim custody of the children, that one or both parties will refrain from disposing of any of the marital assets, that the non-custodial party will have visitation rights, who will have the car, almost anything. Sometimes, under this statute, you get very detailed orders when people are fighting bitterly, and it's basically just to provide some structure after the divorce complaint is filed and before the trial comes or there's a settlement. That's all you really need to know. You need to know that all of those forms of relief are available, and all the party has to do is move the court, fight with the opposition, and hope they get what they want. The next section, which starts on page 8, is child custody. And this is an area where there's been a lot of litigation and a lot of controversy, and there have also been three really recent Supreme Court cases in this area. At the present time, there is a bill in the legislature to amend our custody statute to provide for shared custody or joint custody. I don't know that it's going to pass because it's in the Judiciary Committee now, but it is said its fate is not going to be, it's not going to have a good future. In any event, there is a very active fathers group in Anchorage which is pushing for a revision of our custody statute because they feel that it's biased in favor of mothers and that the children are biased in favor of mothers. The statute which governs custody is 955-205, and basically Alaska has adopted the best interest of the child test for custody, meaning that any decision concerning custody or interim custody or post-divorce custodial relief has to be based on the best interest of the child. And the court is given very, very broad discretion in making custody awards and visitation plans. And the standard on review is whether that discretion has been abused or whether the trial court's findings were clearly erroneous. There's a whole list of factors which we'll go into in a minute that the trial court is supposed to consider in determining what's in the best interest of the child. And there have been a few cases in which the Supreme Court has said that a trial judge has given too much weight to one or other of those factors. And one of the recent cases concerns that situation. The tender years doctrine, which I think is becoming increasingly disfavored throughout the United States, although I think still exists in some states, is in theory abolished in Alaska. The tender years doctrine is the doctrine that if there are little kids, they should go with the mother because mothers are better able to take care of small children. I don't know. I think that's a bias that's very deeply rooted in a lot of people. And so I know certain people, particularly the Fathers' Rights Group, feel that there is a tender years doctrine in practice in Alaska. However, as far as the law goes, there isn't. The trial court judge is supposed to consider the best interests of the children. and that's that. There is no presumption that a child should go to a parent of the same sex. There's no presumption that a child should go to a parent who has greater financial means. The court just takes the view that if one parent has a large income and another parent virtually no income, but that parent looks like he or she would be the better parent, the one with the money can just pay more child support. One of the factors that's considered in awarding child custody is the age of the children. As between unmarried people, the test is the same, and there's been a really recent case on this, which we'll discuss in a minute. The same test applies to what is in the best interest of the child. This comes as a surprise to a lot of people. A lot of women who are unmarried and have children automatically assume that their children's fathers, especially if they don't have anything to do with them any longer, are out of the picture, both practically speaking and as far as any legal rights may be concerned. It's not true. Sexual conduct of one party during a custody fight is of pretty negligible significance unless there's some evidence that it adversely affects the child or the children. This is, again, an area that clients get very worked up about and have a great deal of difficulty understanding how the courts do not take into consideration the fact that perhaps the other spouse has a girlfriend or a boyfriend. There are a couple of ways that sexual conduct can affect a child that the court will look at, and those are situations if, for instance, the child or the children feel that they're being replaced or supplanted by the new person that one of their parents is having a sexual relationship with, or if they're seeing their parents, or they're not their parents, but they're one of their parents and another person engaging in sexual intercourse or aberrational sexual activities or violent sexual activities, things like that, the court is going to say are bound to have an adverse effect on the kids, and they will probably pay a lot of attention to that kind of sexual conduct. But if it's simply a matter of the parties, the parents having split up and one or both of them having formed other relationships, that is not going to make a great deal of difference. Or it's not supposed to make a great deal of difference. Okay, the statute outlines the guidelines the court is to follow in making a custody decision. And one of the first things it says is that if the child is old enough to express a preference, the court should consider the child's preference. There's no age limit on this. The statute just says that the child is of sufficient age and intelligence. And some kids are listened to at quite an early age. Some kids form a preference at quite an early age. Some people, psychologists say that little children's preferences should never be listened to because sometimes they say, or often they say, the exact opposite of what they mean in these situations. I don't know why. Neither parent has any superior right to an award of custody. And the court has to consider all of these factors listed here in your outline on page 8. The physical, emotional, mental, religious, social needs of the child, the capability and desire of the parents to meet the needs, the child's preference, as we just discussed. As far as the child's preference is concerned, it's important that the court look at why a child is expressing a preference, if they are expressing a preference. Oftentimes, kids are bought out or lured over to one side, especially if they're at the age when they're becoming attracted to material things. The love and affection existing between the child and each parent, and this is probably one of the factors that gets a lot of attention, maybe not even consciously, from trial judges, because In many, many marriages, there will be a tighter bond between a parent who isn't working, who stays home with a kid, than the parent who's off working, especially if the working parent is gone a lot. It just seems to happen that way. The length of the time that the child lives in a stable, satisfactory environment and the desirability of maintaining continuity. This is a sort of stability factor, and it's particularly important. At the same time, the Supreme Court has said in a couple of cases that they are not going to be influenced by whom the child was living with most recently, which sounds to me to be a little contradictory. But I think all other things being equal in a custody fight, if the parents sort of tally up same score, the trial court will probably choose on the basis of maintaining stability in the child's life and leave the child where he's been or she's been during the fight. The case of Bonjour versus Bonjour was a case in which the mother was living with another man, and the father felt that this would be a good reason for her to be denied custody. The court reaffirmed what I told you a few minutes ago, that absent any evidence that this was affecting the child adversely, they would not select the father over the mother. Then on page 9 of your outline, there's a whole series of sort of significant custody cases. And you should be pretty familiar with these. One is that it's error for the judge not to listen to the child's preference. So the child's preference is important. Another thing here is that custody disposition has to be in the child's best interest, not the parent's best interest. The Leek case says where neither parent is particularly desirable, the welfare of the child is paramount to the claims of the parents. The Nichols case says that children should be kept together if possible. More recently, in the last couple of months, the Supreme Court has said that this is not really a hard and fast rule. They like the idea that children should be kept together, but they're not going to totally commit themselves to that position, I guess. Here, Carl versus Carl, there's no presumption in favor of a person with whom the child has most recently and continuously resided, which I think is a little contradictory to the statutory criteria concerning stability. Custody decisions shouldn't be made on the basis of cultural assumptions which are not borne out by the record. I think that may happen, though, sometimes. The Johnson case, which has been a big case and been up to the Supreme Court, I think more than one time, stands for the proposition that a parent's membership in a certain religion standing alone is not enough to deny that parent custody. In that case, Mrs. Johnson was a Jehovah's Witness, and the people in her sect encouraged her, or her husband had been excommunicated, and they encouraged her to absolutely deny him visitation. So he moved for a change of custody, and the court denied his motion for a change of custody, but said that they would enforce his visitation rights. And that particular person, Rudy Johnson, is one of the leaders in the Father's Rights Group now, who's so eager to get this new legislation through. Okay. There's a different standard, though, when you're talking about parent versus non-parent custody. Turner versus Panic is the main case in this area, and that says that parents are entitled to preference over grandparents unless it's clearly shown that the parents are unfit. So it's not a best interest test. You have to show that the parents are unfit first. in order to get some other relative into a custodial position. And then if the welfare of the child requires placement with the other relative or the grandparent, the court can do that. But so basically the preference is for awarding custody of children to their parents. This was again affirmed in Britt versus Britt. As between the state of Alaska and a relative, and this situation comes up in termination of parental rights cases sometimes, a relative will be preferred over the state, which means that a relative's home will usually be given preference over a foster home, which I think is probably the best result. In custody cases, the court can appoint a guardian ad litem. They don't have to. They can deny a party's request for a guardian ad litem if they want to. The purpose of a guardian ad litem is to represent the interests of the child. It's a good idea in many custody cases because the parties are, especially if they're very polarized, they're really mainly concerned with their own interests and their own best interests and sort of lose sight of the best interests of the children. The guardian ad litem functions just as the regular attorney. He can file motions, he can preempt the judge. The parents may have to pay the guardian ad litem's fees, split them between them. This has the effect of putting the child in the position of a party in the litigation, and it's generally speaking not a bad idea. There is a certain limitation on it in that the guardian ad litem is appointed by the trial judge and serves at the pleasure of the trial judge, and he or she cannot go hog wild in protecting the child's interests, running up a lot of litigation costs and things like that. So there is that little restraint on it. The main case in that area is, as your outline says, Veazey versus Veazey. And that was the case that concerned the guardian ad litem's right to preempt the judge. Okay. Next thing is, in your outline, which is on page 10, is the other statute that I mentioned a little while ago that doesn't get as much attention as it perhaps should. And it's the action for failure to permit visitation. And when a court order is specific about visitation of a minor child and the custodial parent fails to permit that visitation to occur, the person entitled to it has a cause of action against the custodian for damages. The amount of damages is $200 for each failure to permit visitation. The problem is that a lot of divorce decrees say that the mother will have custody and the father will have generous and liberal visitation. And if you have that kind of divorce decree, this statute doesn't do you any good because it says here the court order has to be specific, so it has to be one of those ones that says every other weekend and alternate Wednesdays or something like that. There's presently a bill in the legislature to raise the amount of the fine to, I think, $300, and I don't know if this will pass, to make failure to permit visitation a Class B misdemeanor, which I think, although I'm not really up on the new criminal code, is the lowest class of misdemeanor. I don't know whether that'll pass or not. That's a fairly heavy penalty for not complying with visitation, but, you know, in certain instances it might do the trick. Custody decisions are appealed. When they're appealed, the standard of review is, has there been an abuse of discretion, or are the findings of fact clearly erroneous? Which basically means that custody decisions are hard to appeal successfully unless there's really been something done by the trial judge that you can pin your appeal on. But many, many Supreme Court opinions say that they do not find there's been an abuse of discretion. They might not have done the same thing as the trial judge, but they can't say it's an abuse of discretion, so they aren't going to reverse the trial court decision. a real recent case, Matson versus Matson. I don't know how many of you have read that. January case came down, involved a custody dispute. That's kind of an interesting case. The parents were divorced, and the child lived with his father's first cousin, and the father lived about 100 yards away. And this case was decided first by a standing master who applied Turner versus Panic, which is the case that establishes the standard for determining parental versus non-parental or grandparental custody. And under that standard, he gave custody to the mother. But he said that had he applied a best interest test, he would have also given custody to the mother. The trial judge, this was, the master's report was objected to, and the trial court said that the father was seeking custody, not the cousin, and on that basis gave custody to the father. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial judge, saying that custody is not simply a matter of physical control or proximity over a child, and they followed best interest analysis through what the trial court had, and agreed that the father should be the custodian, even though he was always going to continue living 100 yards away, and the child was going to continue to live with his cousin. So it's kind of a strange case. Yes?
Can you explain briefly when a divorce case is heard before a special master and when it goes directly to a judge? Or what does you keep mentioning masters.
Yeah. Do I have enough time left on this tape to do that? Yeah. A divorce case goes to a trial judge the first time it goes to trial. Especially in the last couple of years, a lot of post-divorce litigation has been heard by standing masters who are appointed by the court. I think mainly to take the burden off the trial judges, and because there is a lot of post-divorce litigation. Also, a lot of the pendente lite litigation is heard by standing masters. So it's really the trial that goes before the judge. Sometimes a special master is appointed in a divorce trial to make certain particular kinds of findings. If, for instance, the parties have a lot of property and there are a lot of accounting problems, and they need somebody to sort through that and make some findings of fact in that area. But that's not too common.
Is that done on motion, on the judge's own motion, or is it done on one of the parties' motion?
It could be either. Go on.
Take a break.
Yeah. At the break, somebody came up to me and asked me if I would discuss the Matson case again. And somebody else came up and pointed out that in terms of sort of Alaskan realities, it's probably the right decision. It was a custody dispute. The mother moved to modify the father's award of custody because the father didn't actually have the child living with him. The child was living with his cousin, and father lived just down the street. I can't remember what village this was in, but it was out somewhere in western Alaska. And this was heard before the master who applied Turner versus Panic, which is the parent versus non-parent standard, and decided that as between the cousin and the mother should be preferred and the custody should be switched to her. And then the master also added in a little aside saying he would have found it in the best interest of the child to go with the mother had he applied a best interest analysis. The trial court, when this was objected and brought to the trial judge's attention, rejected the master's determination and said that the father was the actual custodian and not his cousin, and on that basis gave custody to the father. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial court, saying that custody is not just a matter of physical control over the child. It's a sort of broader concept, and following a best interest analysis, they found that it was in the best interest of the child to be in his father's custody. But it was not disputed, apparently, that the child was going to go on living with his father's cousin. But but nonetheless they found that the father was the custodian. So it's, you know, it's probably the best for the child. It's just kind of an odd case. Another January custody case is Craig versus McBride. And this involved two unmarried people. It was a custody dispute which the Supreme Court remanded because it found that the original award might have been based on what they called impermissible criteria. The trial court, which I believe was the trial court in Juneau, gave the father custody because he was more able to provide a stable environment for the child. And in doing this, it referred to the fact that the mother had three children out of wedlock and had demonstrated a lot of instability in her personal relationships. The Supreme Court said, and their words were, we cannot countenance reference to the mother's sexual conduct. And unless it could be shown to adversely affect the child or the mother's parenting abilities, it shouldn't have been considered. The Supreme Court also said that consideration should have been given to the desirability of not separating the child in question from her half-sister, who was not at issue in the action. But again, they said that they were not making a hard and fast rule about not separating the kids, but that that's an important factor. And then finally, they said, another little twist at the end of this case, they said the trial court, when it heard this again, would have to consider the effect of the child having spent the 2 years that it took for the appeal process with her father, even though this would penalize the mother, who was the prevailing party on appeal. So, have to wait to see what happens with that one. But that's another kind of interesting case, and it's a very recent one. So, it's probably one you should be aware of. Okay, the next section is on child support. It's an area of great trouble and problems in domestic relations. In order for the court to make an award, child support has to have in personam jurisdiction. And child support is based on the needs of the child or the children and the ability of the parents to pay. It can be paid directly to the parents, or it can be paid through the Child Support Enforcement Agency, which is a department within the State Department of Revenue. And there is a duty, although lots of people are surprised to find this, there is a duty to pay child support in the absence of any order or judgment. Parents just have a duty to support their children. There's a series of cases listed in your outline on page 11. The first one saying that each spouse has an obligation to support children regardless of the spouse's sex, and even though their abilities to furnish support may be unequal. A child can proceed independently for child support against his parents or guardian, and the child's creditors can also move for child support. I don't know that this happens all that often, except in cases where the state is chasing child support for the child because they've paid out welfare money. Spouses have an obligation to support each other. If one spouse can't support himself, the other one is supposed to support him or her. And Young versus Williams case is a few years old, said that payments that are made voluntarily to children, such as gifts or wages, don't satisfy child support obligation or not be used to reduce the child support obligation. That's an area that comes up quite a bit. One parent is ordered to pay child support and is very resentful about it, and so they'll say, well, I don't think I should pay this month, but I bought him a bicycle and I bought him some clothes, and so I've done my part. And court will say, no, you did that as a volunteer. You still have to pay your $400 or $500 a month, however much child support has been set. And child support payments, each child support payment, as it accrues or becomes due, is a judgment. And the statute of limitations on that is the statute of limitations for judgments in general, which is 10 years. So if you have a situation where a child is getting child support until they're 18, the last time that the mother can sue for the child support payment would be on the child's 28th birthday. When child support isn't being paid, there's sort of two avenues that people pursue. One is to haul the non-payer into court on a contempt motion, and that's not real successful because then they demand a jury trial, and then you have a big mess, and no money is forthcoming for the children. So the best way is to reduce the child support arrearages to judgment and execute on whatever you can find to execute on. Oftentimes, it'll have to be the father's salary or the mother's if she's the one that's not paying.
Does anyone beside the custodial parent have standing to sue to enforce? Payment of child support.
On a practical basis, yes, because anyone receiving welfare or AFDC signs an assignment of their rights.
Yeah, so in that situation, yeah. I don't know of any other situations in which they can. A recent case, well, not so recent actually, it was early last year, Hinchey versus Hinchey, made it perfectly clear that the court can award child support beyond the age of majority. In this case, they awarded it to the age of 23. This is an area of a lot of squabbling. A lot of people maintain that the statute should be interpreted to say that child support stops at 18. Not so in Alaska. It can go on forever. Okay, going to modification of child support. In order to modify a child support decree, the person who's seeking the modification has to show either that the child's needs are less or the changed conditions in the parent's financial abilities justify reducing the burden on the parents by paying less child support. Curley versus Curley is the important case in the area of reduction of child support payments. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that a modification of a support order seeking to reduce child support can only be obtained where there's material and substantial change in circumstances of a more or less permanent rather than temporary nature. And the change of circumstances cannot have arisen out of some kind of voluntary act of the party seeking the reduction. For instance, if the father wants to have his child support reduced because he quit his job because he thought it would be nice to be a sculptor or just stay home and read books for a year, the court isn't going to be one bit sympathetic. They're not going to say, even though your income has dropped by 75%, you still have to pay the child support that you were ordered to pay before you embarked on this new lifestyle. And as it says in your outline, the factors that the court has to take into consideration of whether the child's needs are less than they were at the time of the divorce, that's very, very unusual. They're almost always greater. About the only situation I think that would occur would be if a child had to have some kind of special treatment or special care at the time of the divorce and had grown beyond that period. Yeah?
Is inflation a grounds for going back in?
For modifying upwards, yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. To modify a child support award upwards, you also have to show a change of circumstances. Sometimes the court will attempt to hold people to the material and substantial change of circumstances, but for the most part, courts have been pretty sympathetic to motions to modify child support to increase it. I think, too, that you're probably all aware that there's no such thing as a final order in this whole child custody, child support visitation area. It can always be reopened until child grows up. So is always an area, potential area of post-divorce litigation. One specific...
Is there any litigation regarding a non-custodial parent's duty to pay a child's college?
There is quite a bit of litigation. I mean, a lot of times people will try to include that in the original decree of divorce. But I've seen several cases in which mothers have gone back in on behalf of their teenage children saying that their father, the decree had said until the age of majority, and go back in and say the father should pay for their college education.
Okay.
Is that your question?
I don't know how to correctly frame it. I think when divorced, generally children are in their minor years. And I don't know if college rises to substantial changes of circumstance, because it seems to me college is a choice. It's not a mandatory need of food, clothing, shelter in terms of circumstances. And that choice seems to go above the original decree.
Well,
Do girls need to be educated as opposed to boys?
I can see what you're saying, although I have seen cases in which the trial court has said that the decision to go to college or the fact that it wasn't considered in the original decree and is now an actual problem in the family is a substantial change in circumstances. I think the courts are usually sympathetic to increases in child support. One thing that comes up in child support modification situations concerns the effects of subsequent marriages on the part of either the payor or the payee parent. If, say, the husband, who's the payor, marries, and his wife works and brings income into his home, her salary can't be counted as part of his actual income when it comes to calculating how much money he has and how much he can afford to pay in child support. But the court can consider that her salary, the money she's bringing in, is diminishing his expenses to some extent. In other words, if, and this, you see this quite frequently, the husband will have a good job, and the wife will have a good job, the new wife will have a good job, and the husband will, on his financial declaration, claim that he is paying for 100% of the house payment, 100% of the utilities, and all of the food, and all of the clothing, and all of the insurance, and both car payments, leaving the impression that his wife gets to keep her salary and doesn't have to do anything with it, which in reality is probably not what happens. So the court will sort of look at the effect of her salary on his expenses. If the husband, who is charged with a child support obligation, remarries, and he remarries a woman who has a bunch of kids, and those kids need support, his obligation first remains to his own children. He's just going to have to spread himself thinner if he wants to take care of those other kids. He can't get out of his obligation to support the original children by saying, look, I married this woman and she has four children, and her husband's disappeared, and they really need me more than the old kids. That won't work. He's acting as a volunteer as far as his new family is concerned. If a wife remarries and her new husband is real wealthy, that does nothing to diminish the husband's, former husband's, obligation to pay child support. And I'm saying a husband is the one that pays and wife is the one that gets, because that is still what happens in most cases. And of course, it could apply the other way around. It's just sort of habit that I put it that way. In any event, the first husband's child support obligation remains exactly the same, even though the wife's new husband may be fabulously wealthy. And the only thing that would change it is if new husband adopts the children. Okay, now another real recent case, which is in the child support area, which is a case that Ken did the appeal on, Hedlow versus Hedlow, and that was decided last month also. And it's another is another somewhat odd case. Seven and a half months after the divorce decree was entered, the mother moved to modify to increase her child support, saying that she couldn't make ends meet. And again, this was heard at first before a master who found that there was no showing of a substantial material change in circumstances, and who also found that the parties were basically in the same financial positions they'd been in at the time of the divorce. And so he said, no increase, you're out of luck. The wife objected to the master's report, and the Superior Court increased her child support from $400 to $600 a month. So the husband appealed the Superior Court's decision, and saying that the master's findings were not clearly erroneous and that they should be adhered to. And the Supreme Court said, first about the master's report, that it can be disregarded by the Superior Court, that his recommendation, the master's recommendation, is just that, it's a recommendation, but it's not controlling. And they said, with respect to material and substantial change of circumstances, that they found some merit in the husband's argument that there had been no real change in circumstances, but that in child support cases, as in child custody cases, their real concern is with the best interest and the welfare of the children. And that this concern, which is so paramount in child custody cases, can lap over into the area of child support. So then they found that there had been a change of circumstances in that there was a mistaken assumption made when the decree was first entered, and that the real needs of the mother were something different than what had been assumed 7 months earlier. So it seems to me it's saying because she didn't figure out what she needed at the time of the divorce, she was able to say there was a change of circumstances 7 months later. And the case was remanded, however, because the trial judge didn't make findings of fact. So that's the case that might come up on your exam. It's certainly a recent one. It's certainly going to cause some trouble in the future, I think. It's putting changes of circumstances into a sort of much more subjective category. Okay, this takes us now to property division, which is a real important area. And I guess this is about page 12 in your outline. Alaska is not a community property state, but our property division laws are similar to those of some community property states, except that we don't have a lot of the very specific rules that a state such as California has. Basically, in Alaska, all property acquired during the marriage will be divided equitably between the parties when they divorce. And more often than not, the divisions of property are 50-50. The longer a marriage has lasted, the more this 50-50 may vary in favor of one of the parties, 60-40, 80-20. Page 12 of your outline has our old property division statute in there, and then the new one, which was changed, and which reads that property is divided between the parties, whether joint or separate, acquired only during coverture, in a manner as may be just, though it doesn't actually say 50-50, and without regard to which of the parties is in fault. So it's the no-fault property division statute. That's something that's very hard for a lot of people to understand. A lot of clients really feel that property should be a vehicle for punishing the one who's been worse in the marriage. And the court, in dividing the property, can invade the property of either spouse acquired before marriage when balancing the equities between the parties if justice requires it. So, basically, as I said, it's a no-fault statute. It doesn't matter who filed for divorce. And marital misdeeds are not going to count one way or the other in a property division. So the court, in a trial where property has to be divided looks at all of the property acquired during the marriage, regardless of whose name it's in, it doesn't matter if it's all in the husband's name or all in the wife's name, and divides it according to certain criteria, which are known as the Merrill factors, which I'll discuss in just a second. And if this doesn't bring about an equitable result, the court will then invade property held prior to the marriage or separately acquired during the marriage. So it's a kind of a two-step process. The court won't get into the premarital or the separate property unless there seems to be some reason to do so. And not infrequently, they do find a reason to do so, to invade the premarital property. As your outline says, the statute was basically following the case law, and the leading case in this area is the Merrill case, which sets out the factors the courts to consider, and those are on page 13. They are the respective ages of the parties, their earning ability, the duration and conduct of each during marriage, their station in life, the circumstances and necessities of each, their health and physical condition, and their financial circumstances, including the time and manner of acquisition of the property in question as valuing its income-producing capacity, if any. Okay, so some of these factors get more attention than others. Conduct doesn't mean who is good and who is bad, who is unfaithful, who drank too much. Conduct means how they lived their lives while they were married. Did the husband work all the time? Did the wife stay home and take care of the house? Did they travel around the world a lot? Did they both work very hard at improving a homestead lot or something like that? So it really is addressing, to a large extent, the party's economic lifestyle during their marriage. Station in life means that, to the extent possible, the court will try to keep the parties at the same economic level after divorce as before divorce. This is kind of a joke because you have to have really wealthy people to be able to divorce and pay their attorneys and take vacations to get over the divorce and come back and be in the same economic position they were in when they were still married. I think in practice, I've seen some statistics that most women go rapidly downhill economically after a divorce, and men go down for a little while and then bounce back up. So, nonetheless, the court is supposed to try to keep them in the position they were in before the divorce. Circumstances and necessities of each is pretty self-explanatory. Duration of marriage is real important for property division. In a short-term marriage, property will probably be divided 50-50. And the court probably won't start to look at the premarital property unless there's some really compelling reason. But in a long-term marriage, which I would put it anywhere from 12 to 15 years and on, 20, 30, 40-year marriages, the court often can't sort out the premarital property unless it's separate property that's recently been acquired, and the court is able to find more reasons to invade that property. A fairly recent case, Cook versus Cook, had an interesting discussion of the premarital property issue. I think that's in your supplement. The husband brought $40,000 into the marriage, and the marriage lasted for 11 years. The husband didn't work much at all during the marriage, and he was not prevented from working by health reasons or anything like that. He just didn't want to work. The wife worked pretty much the whole time through the marriage. And so the court found that her contribution to the marriage had been $50,000 more than the husband. And the court also found that they had an equity in properties worth about $30,000. And the court awarded this $30,000 to the wife. And the Supreme Court said that there was no abuse of discretion in doing this. Obviously, the trial court judge was not at all impressed with Mr. Cook and his contributions to the marriage or his conduct during the marriage. So it's a good example of the court taking conduct into consideration.
Please turn the tape over at this point and continue listening to side two.
This might be an area in which you'll get a question, because it's always coming up, the premarital and extramarital property problem. Rest of cases on page 13 are just cases which uphold marital and are more recent. Vanover broadens marital a little bit by saying the trial court should consider any other factors bearing on whether the equities dictate that the other spouse is entitled to share in the property. So there's sort of a long string of cases affirming the marital standards. Vanover was also a case that involved extramarital property, and the court said, the Supreme Court said the trial court had the power to invade the property of the spouse apart prior to the marriage when any other division would have been very unjust to the other spouse. This was a situation where one spouse had made contributions to the marital community, and these contributions had benefited the separate property of the other spouse acquired before marriage. The trial court is able to say that all or a portion of that property can be included in the property acquired after marriage and considered for up for grabs when making a just division of the property. Situations where a property division of or a division of property solely acquired during the marriage might be unjust would be a situation in which the wife, it's been a long marriage, the wife hasn't worked, has no work skills, or is in poor health. There's been a lot of litigation outside, but not so much here, on the value of homemaker services and housewife contributions. Those issues haven't been addressed in any really direct way in Alaska yet, but I think in a case like this, there's a sort of recognition of that problem. Probably the most celebrated case on the invasion of separate property is the Burrell case, which is still being litigated, I believe. Mr. Burrell was the beneficiary of a trust fund before his marriage to Mrs. Burrell, and she also contributed $50,000 that she had inherited to the joint property. I think that what happened was basically they spent her $50,000 and went to trial for their divorce, and Mr. Burrell said, well, my trust is separate premarital property, so don't include it, and the trial court didn't. And the Supreme Court reversed the trial court, saying that it was error not to invade his separate trust because both of the financial situation of the parties and also because the husband was able to keep the separate intact because of the contributions made by the wife. In that case, in a footnote, said that it would treat an inheritance as premarital property. And that appears to be the law on inheritances in Alaska. In some states, inheritances are very clearly premarital property, or they're premarital property by virtue of statute. We don't have any statutory reference in Alaska, so this seems to be our main authority for that. So just bear in mind, if you get a separate property, premarital property type question, it's not so likely in a short marriage that it will be invaded. In a long marriage, it's much more likely. Another question which arises in this area of property division concerns appreciation of premarital property. Should it be divided as marital property, or does it remain as premarital property and separate? And if any of you went to law school in California, you'll know that California has fairly clear-cut rules for dealing with this situation. But we don't. An example would be that a husband had $50,000 when he married his wife, and 5 years later they divorced, and husband's property is worth $75,000. Assuming that there's no other reason to invade the separate property, is the $25,000 appreciation going to be considered to be marital property? Well, the Supreme Court had this question in front of it in Hinchey versus Hinchey. And the trial court had ruled that the appreciation was a marital asset. The Supreme Court ducked the issue by saying that the trial court was empowered to invade a premarital asset in the interest of equity, and they didn't find any reason to disturb the trial court's property division. So they didn't really want to come right out and say, yes, the appreciation is a marital asset, or no, the appreciation is not a marital asset. They got out of having to take position on that for the time being. But I think it's going to come up again and again. One of the cases in your supplement, Curse Lake, is a real short opinion. It just says that the court can accept a property settlement agreement entered into by the parties without conducting an independent inquiry into the merits of the agreement. And that's what they do all the time. They just ask the parties if they think it's fair and equitable, and the parties say yes, and it becomes part of the decree of divorce. Another case in your supplement is Rostell versus Rostell, and it concerns the income earning capacity of a closely held professional corporation owned by a married couple, but the income was all earned through the efforts of one of the spouses. And the court said that this is property that is subject to division as a marital asset. This is an area that hasn't been litigated, at least to our Supreme Court level, very much in Alaska, but there's been a tremendous amount of litigation outside, particularly involving doctors and lawyers and the value of doctors' practices and their spouses' interests. And different states have taken different positions, and it's quite a hot issue in other states. I think it's just a matter of time till we have more of these cases coming along. Okay, there's a little section in the outline on appellate review of property division. It's very similar to appellate review of custody decisions. The trial court has broad discretion and won't be overturned on appeal unless the clear evidence that they've made an unjust division. You really need a clear abuse of discretion to disturb the trial court's findings. The Rossum case, in which the property division was affirmed as not being an abuse of discretion, involved a mingling of separate and joint property. And it was a very short marriage. And the court found that it was the party's intent to treat all of their property except for two parcels of real estate as joint, and so they just divided it equally. And the party, I think it was the wife, who had had all of the property before the marriage, was of course very unhappy and appealed, but didn't get anywhere. Again, in the property division area, a little bit in a procedural problem of its own, is the Olink case. And that was decided in July of this year. And in the Olink case, there was an appeal from Superior Court judgment modifying the divorce decree. The parties both filed motions to modify the divorce decree 2.5 years after the decree was entered. And the Supreme Court said because they were not filed within the time limit set out in Rule 60B, which is 1 year, the Superior Court lacked jurisdiction to entertain the party's motions. The Superior Court did entertain the motions, felt it had jurisdiction, and redistributed the property, went on to the Supreme Court, and they said this. This is kind of an important case for practitioners because there's an awful lot of litigation under Rule 60B in the property settlement area. Property settlements can't be modified like child custody decrees and child support decrees, visitation decrees. And so if somebody's unhappy with one, their best bet is to bring a motion under Rule 60B. Not that it's always successful, but it's the vehicle is used most of the time. And so the court is clamping down and saying 1 year. 1 year in the rule, we're going to go by the 1 year in the rule. And Rule 60B does have a sort of a catch-all that makes it sound as though you can get around the 1 year requirement, but the Supreme Court said no. Next area. And I don't know if you'll be questioning this because it's everybody. Even people who aren't lawyers know this now, concerns military retirement. And the Alaska Supreme Court decided a couple of years ago in Coast versus Coast that the military retired pay was the separate property of the retired military person. And lots of people felt that this was a really unjust decision. And it was appealed to the Supreme Court, but I can't remember if the Supreme Court granted cert or not. It was considering several other cases from other states. And last June or July in the McCarty case, this is the United States Supreme Court now, the United States Supreme Court held that military retirement pay is the separate property of the retired spouse. And of course, there are a lot of people who feel it's a terrible decision. And there are a lot of people trying to get some kind of legislation in Congress to change this. The McCarty case was a California case, and the Supreme Court said that the California community property position vis-a-vis military retirement, which was that it should be split, threatened to diminish a benefit that Congress says should go to the retired military person. And they found a direct conflict between California's community property position and the congressionally enacted retirement scheme. So under the Supremacy Clause, community property position had to yield to the federal legislation. And it's an interesting opinion to read. It's a bad opinion, I think. The Supreme Court also mentioned such concerns as the need for a youthful and vigorous military and inducements to enlistment and re-enlistment and things like this. I have a lot of trouble with it. You know, people who are representing retired military people, I guess, like the decision, but it's really very, very unfair because frequently, or almost always, people who are in the military long enough to get a pension or retirement benefits, which is 20 years, have moved around, and they don't acquire a lot of property. They often live on base, and they don't buy houses and get the benefit of inflation as many other people, civilian people, have done. So they don't end up at retirement time with very much except maybe the furniture, vehicles, and the retirement, which is a pretty good benefit. But now it's entirely the retired spouse's. He doesn't have to share it. with his wife. You can still, and in Alaska, this has been successfully done, ask the retired military spouse pay spousal support to his wife out of his retired military benefits or out of whatever money he has. And if that's all he's got, he's going to have to pay it out of that. But it is, I think some states have stricter rules about alimony, and in most states, the spouses are out of luck. So I don't know if that'll come up because it's there's been so much publicity. Probably the person writing the exam figures everybody knows that. In Alaska, the other retirement area is, you should know about, is civil service retirement pay. And there are two cases that deal with that, the Malone case and the Monsma case. And they say that vested civil service retirement benefits are divisible marital property. And that's pretty clear. That doesn't stop some people from arguing that civil service benefits should be treated as retired military benefits and not be divisible. But the cases are very clear that they're divisible.
When is vesting, upon retirement or upon a certain time period of that?
With the civil service? I'm not sure. I think it may be after a certain period of time. It's a sort of gradual vesting. But
five
I'm not
years.
Positive.
5 years.
5 years? Yeah.
And what happens if it's non-vested?
Maybe partial
My best answer to that is it would depend on the trial judge. I think that what they would probably, if it's not vested, I think what they'd probably try to do is adjust the property division so that the spouse who doesn't have the pension coming to her gets more or something else. And this is also the rule, at least in general practice, although it's not really been articulated in the cases, for just regular private type pensions, that they're divisible marital property. Okay, the next section in your outline is alimony. And the statute says that either party can get alimony without regard to fault. The Malone case, which is a case that's 3 or 4 years old, said that alimony is not favored and the financial needs of the spouses should be provided by property distribution rather than by alimony. And that is, or was, the Supreme Court's view at that time. That's all well and good, but it just doesn't work out in many situations. It works out okay when people have a lot of money or have income producing assets or things like that, but many other situations it just doesn't work out. The Messina case, which is also 3 or 4 years old, is another important case in the alimony area. It said that although Alaska hasn't adopted the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, they were going to use the standards that alimony be just and necessary. And if there could be a finding that it was just and necessary, the court could award it. The conditions under which it should be granted are when one party is unable to work because of health problems, lack of education, or child care obligations. For alimony to continue after the death of the person who's paying it, there has to be a specific agreement in the property settlement agreement to that effect, or it stops when the paying spouse, who's usually the husband, dies. Just reminds me, although it doesn't have to do with alimony, that when people divorce, by statute, I don't know the number, but it's in Title 13, a person's will, insofar as it makes bequests to a spouse, automatically becomes void as to the former spouse. So a lot of people worry about that. They're divorced, but they haven't changed their will, and they think if they die, that the person that they just got rid of is going to get all of the things that they left them when they made the will, when the marriage was going well. But not so. is as though that portion of the will is excised by statute. One set of problems, whole set of problems in the alimony area comes up concerning what tax treatment should be given. An alimony is tax deductible if the payments are periodic over a period of 10 years or their non-occurrence occurs because of either the marriage of the wife, the death of the wife, or the death of the husband. There's been a lot of tax court litigation about payment of alimony and deductions taken for alimony. I don't think that you're going to have to know too much of that for the bar exam. I hope not. None of that litigation takes place in our state court, both taking place.
Is alimony characterized as either support alimony or alimony in lieu of a property division in decrees?
Well, it could be either way.
If it's support alimony, can you enforce it by contempt?
Yes.
Yes. Is that distinction an important one in terms of whether you can seek the contempt from you?
I don't think it really is. No. Our most recent case concerning alimony is the Bissell case, in which the Supreme Court approved an award of rehabilitative alimony because it was of limited duration and for a specific purpose. So it seems to be somewhat softening the view it took in the Malone case when it said we disfavor alimony. Now it's saying it's okay for rehabilitation. And in practice, there are a lot of awards of rehabilitative alimony. The Bissell case also might not come up on your bar exam since it seems to come up on the last one, but the Supreme Court took the opportunity to say that they're not going to adopt the doctrine of equitable divorce, which is the doctrine that says that for purposes of property division, the date of separation will be the date at which the counting begins or to which the counting goes. The court said that in Alaska it's the date of divorce. And this can make quite a difference because frequently people can be separated or in litigation for a couple of years. Or I had one client who had been separated from her husband for 10 years before he sued her for divorce. And she was able to reap the benefits for the 10 years that they'd actually been living independent economic existences. Okay, another pretty recent case, it was a November case, is the Van Brocklin case. And this is another case involving, I think, a hearing in front of the master. There was originally an uncontested divorce hearing. I guess the husband showed up and the wife filed an appearance and waiver and didn't appear, which means that she signed a piece of paper saying, I'm not going to appear and contest and waive my rights in this action. And all the decree said at the time was that the property rights had been amicably settled without any need for court adjudication. But 17 months later, the wife went back to court asking for alimony, for delivery of personal property, and for a just and equitable division of the party's property. So I bring this case up in this area because one of the issues that it raises is alimony. And first dealing with the request for property division, the Supreme Court said that the master had been mistaken when he characterized the request for property division as one for relief from judgment under Rule 60B, and therefore denying it because they'd gone 17 months and beyond the one-year standard. The court said the wife was seeking an adjudication of issues that had been withdrawn from the court's consideration at the time of divorce. And so because those issues had never been before the court, they could now be brought before the court. The Supreme Court said on the alimony issue, the husband was arguing strenuously and citing a lot of authority from other states that because she had never had an original award of alimony, in the decree, she couldn't later on ask for alimony. The Supreme Court said that they feel that our statute, which talks about alimony, which was 955.210, authorizes the later award of alimony, even though the original decree might be silent as to alimony. So here we have a situation where a divorce decree that's silent as to property issues isn't going to operate as a bar to a later action involving division of that property. It's kind of another interesting case, and again, it's a recent one. The next section, which is on page 15 of your outline, is just kind of pretty basic stuff. It says what goes in a judgment for divorce. You can just read through it and see. Payment of child support, which can be done by payroll deduction, alimony, delivery of personal property, property division, changing the names of one of the parties. This isn't just a provision to allow a wife to change back to her maiden name. Either the parties can change their name, or a wife can change back to a prior married name if she wants to. Or I had a client who changed to her grandmother's name. So it's kind of a broad name change provision without having to go through a separate name change proceeding. And then right at the bottom of that says the court has continuing jurisdiction to make modifications, which we've already discussed. The next section is on post-divorce change of custody. And starts out by saying changes of custody are not ordered lightly, which is pretty true. Again, the standard is the best interest of the child. And there's a heavy burden of persuasion on the party asking for the modification. Sometimes the court will say it wants to see a substantial change of circumstance, but this is not an absolute requirement, as the Nichols case said, in bringing a motion for modification of custody. Case in the middle of last year, however, that's in your supplement, held that the court could consider the motion, but it didn't have to hold a hearing on the issue of a change of custody if it felt that the proof of the grounds asserted for a change of custody wouldn't justify the change. So this is sort of a checking mechanism that the court, the Supreme Court, is approving the trial court using, saying, I don't feel that you've come into court and given me sufficient reason to think that there needs to even be a hearing on change of custody in this case. And that's the Divert versus O'Connell case. There is a recent case, fairly recent case, about 6 or 8 months old on change of custody. Do we have much more time on this case, Kim?
2 minutes.
Okay, maybe we should go to the next case. Then. Okay, there's another pretty recent case on change of custody. It's a May 81 case, Sanguinetti versus Sanguinetti. And the mother brought a motion to modify custody within the father. And this was a situation in which the Supreme Court found an abuse of discretion by the trial court because it denied the mother's motion to enforce an order for a home study and to reopen the case. Essentially what had happened was the father had the kids and he had gone back to drinking, and the mother kept trying to get the Department of Health and Social Services out to do a home study of her home, and they never got there, and the hearing date came around, and she arrived at the hearing without the report of Health and Social Services, and the court told her, sort of, tough luck, we're going ahead at this point. And the Supreme Court said the trial court shouldn't have done that. And then in November, the Supreme Court decided the case of Starkweather versus Currit. This is, I think, a kind of funny case. Again, it was a motion by a mother to change custody from the father to her of the children. And the father didn't appear at the hearing. He just sent a letter into the court saying he was opposed to the change. And all of the evidence at the hearing indicated that the mother was an excellent custodian, although at one time, earlier on, the state had petitioned to terminate her parental rights, but apparently she'd overcome whatever problem she had. However, the Superior Court denied her motion, and the Supreme Court upheld the Superior Court because she failed to show that the father was an inadequate parent or wasn't providing suitable environment for the kids. In other words, she just didn't have any evidence on about the father. And the court said that the fact that the mother is as capable of raising the kids as the father doesn't warrant changing custody. So the poor woman probably thought she had it made when her husband didn't turn up for the hearing and ended up finding out that she was out of luck. She didn't get what she wanted. Okay, on page 16 of your outline, the outline talks about custody decrees of other states and the Hart versus Lehman and Wilsonoff cases. These cases are no longer the law here. The law is now the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, which it is not a bad idea to read in full, although it's rather tedious. I think that the summary here is pretty good. The Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act provides that the Superior Court may not exercise its jurisdiction to entertain a custody proceeding if there's one pending in the courts of another state acting in substantial conformity with the Act, unless the courts of the other state have stayed that action to allow the Alaska action to proceed. Time and place of filing of the modification is determinative, and the fact that Alaska is the state of initial jurisdiction where the divorce decree was granted is not, and that was the Layton case. It's also under the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act that a child has to have resided in Alaska 6 months prior to the commencement of an action for the court to be able to make a custody determination about him or her. Basically, the Act says Alaska doesn't have jurisdiction unless it's the home state of the child, where the child has resided for 6 months before the commencement of the action. And the child can't be in the state illegally, and the child can't be here visiting from another state. The whole purpose of this Act, which has been enacted in a number of states, is to discourage forum shopping and flight from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, which still goes on anyway. We've had one case that involved the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, and that was, I think, beginning of 1980, the Rexford case. It was at the end of 1980. And this was a case in which the couple was married and living in Alaska, had two children. The wife took the children without consulting her husband to California and immediately filed a petition for separation in California. The husband appeared in California to contest custody, and after temporary custody had been awarded to his wife, and the permanent custody matter was going on in California, the husband came back to Alaska and filed for divorce in Alaska. The Alaska court, under the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, stayed its proceedings relative to custody because there were pending proceedings in California. Alaska was really the state that should have had jurisdiction. It was the home state, the state where the child or children had lived within 6 months prior to the commencement of the California action. It was the state where the parents had lived. California was claiming it had jurisdiction based on the significant connection basis of the act, which Alaska hasn't adopted. In any event, the Supreme Court of Alaska decided to concede the matter to California because, and I've never understood this, they said this is one of the particular situations where it is more appropriate for Alaska to yield its jurisdiction to California. California had done a massive child custody investigation and the court was better, therefore, able to hear the case. I think they'd done a 39-page report. Their probation department had done a 39-page report. So that, to me, has always seemed like a very odd case. But that's what our Supreme Court has said in the one situation which it had to deal with the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act. sort of saying, yeah, we go along with this, and in this situation, we're going to sort of not enforce it. Something you probably should know about, I don't know if it'll come up on your exam, but it's sort of a close cousin to this, is the Prevention of Parental Kidnapping Act, which is a federal statute, 28 U.S.C. 1738A, and it went into effect last July. It adopts a lot of the language of the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act and reads a lot like it. Its key provisions are that all states are required to give full faith and credit to prior custody determinations rendered by another state, that the Federal Parent Locator Service is made available to assist in finding parents who flee with their children in violation of existing state orders on custody or to avoid potential ones, and that parental kidnapping, if it's a violation of a state penalty, a state felony statute, makes parents who are running off with their children violators of federal criminal code provisions concerning interstate or international flight to avoid prosecution. And supposedly, under this statute, you're able to call in the FBI if your kid has been kidnapped by your spouse or former spouse. I haven't heard too much about how it's working. It's only been in effect for 8 or 9 months. And the purpose is pretty obvious. It's to promote cooperation between states in enforcement of custody and visitation orders, and to discourage interstate controversies and conflicts, and to disturb interstate abductions of children. The next section I have, although it isn't quite in your outline, I think this material is probably in your supplement, is on attorney fees in divorce cases. And the regular Rule 82 attorney fees do not apply in divorce cases. The prevailing party concept doesn't apply. Attorney fees are to be based on the relative economic situations and earning powers of the parties. That's what the Cook case said, and then more recently, Crawford versus State said that the court is to take into consideration the parties' relative situations, earning power, and the amount of time, fees, and effort expended by the parties in the prosecution of the action. So again, this is really another area where the trial court has a lot of discretion, which it doesn't have in other civil litigation in awarding attorney's fees. This brings us to a completely different area, which is adoption. And the things to watch out for in adoption problems are whose consents are necessary and to whom notice should be given. The outline is pretty clear here. It pretty much follows the statute. The first section tells you who can adopt, and they're pretty much kinds of people you think ought to be able to adopt. So I think you can read that through for yourselves. On page 17, paragraph 3, it starts to discuss the consents that are necessary for adoptions of minors. And you need the consent of the mother, you need the consent of the father, if the father was married at the time the minor was conceived, or legitimated the child. Any person lawfully entitled to custody has to consent. The court has to consent if they have jurisdiction to determine custody of a minor, or if the guardian is not empowered to consent. The minor, if they're over 10 years old, has to consent unless for some reason the court dispenses with the need for their consent. And then the next statute, which is AS 2016-050, talks about the people whose consents are not required. But these are the people who have to be given notice. And it's a parent who's abandoned a child for not less than 6 months, a parent of a child in the custody of another if they fail to communicate with that child significantly for a period of 1 year. The father of a minor, if his consent is not required by the previous statute, which said that the father's consents were required if they were married or had legitimated the children. A parent whose parental rights have been terminated has to get notice. A parent who's judicially declared an incompetent has to be given notice. Any parent of the person to be adopted, if the person is over 19, or any guardian or custodian, and spouse of the person to be adopted. So you just have to sort of memorize whose consent you need and which people are in the category that don't have to consent but have to be given notice. Most of the litigation in the adoption area has centered around consent and the abandonment sort of issues. This case is cited in your outline, your supplement, DLJ versus WDR, which was a pretty recent case, November 1981 case, concerned a father who hadn't had much contact with his child, and the petitioner, who was the stepfather, was trying to say that his consent was not required because he had failed under Section B of 2015-050 to communicate with his child meaningfully for a period of 1 year. In this case, the father had been encouraged to stay away from the child and been told not to send child support and to stay out of the state. And the father was very young and sort of mixed up and tended to believe his ex-wife when she said it was better for the child's emotional stability if he stayed away. But nonetheless, he did make regular payments into an out-of-state bank account for the child. And the court found that his consent to the adoption was necessary, that he had made a sufficient attempt to keep some kind of contact with his child. And given the circumstances of the petitioner and his ex-wife discouraging him, he hadn't fallen within that subsection of the statute I just read. The court said that statutes dispensing with consent for adoption are to be strictly construed in favor of natural parents. Consent to adopt can be with...
And some of these people who require notice, like, once you note them, are they necessary parties?
No.
You just send them a letter and
give them notice and hope that you never hear from them.
If you do hear from them, since their consent's not required, what would somebody whose rights have been terminated, not in the best interest of the child, to me, the fact that they get notice implies they have some due process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the fact that they get notice gives them a chance to turn up and say that they don't really fall into the category of people whose consent can be dispensed with. And that's the context in which I've seen it happen most frequently.
Mm-hmm. Who did you say must be notified? There are two categories here.
Right.
Consents are required and consents are not required.
Yeah, all of the ones that say consents are not required have to get notice.
Also, they get notice.
Mm-hmm. After a decree of adoption has been entered, a consent cannot be withdrawn, although it can be withdrawn all the way up to the time of the adoption hearing. 1979 case in your outline, adoption of LAH, says that a father can legitimate a child by an acknowledgement of paternity in writing at an adoption proceeding, and following his doing that, his consent is then required under AS 2015-040, which is the statute that says whose consents are required. So that is probably a situation where he was given notice, but his consent was not requested because he wasn't originally in the category of people who had to consent, and he turned up and said, oh, here I am, and I'm going to legitimate this child, and then they had to deal with him on a consent issue. And it says here, in this case, the petition was dismissed. Again, another case in your supplement, adoption of EMM, says the same thing, that in applying the statute that dispenses with consent adoption, the statute is to be strictly construed in favor of the natural parent. AS 20-1570 says that you can withdraw consent to adoption within 10 days by delivery of written notice to the person obtaining the consent, or after 10 days if the court finds and after notice an opportunity to be heard that the withdrawal is in the best interest of the child, but you can't withdraw it after the decree of adoption has been entered. Another case, the 79 case, in your supplement concerns equitable adoption, and this is kind of interesting. It comes up in cases of intestate succession, and it treats the child as adopted for the purposes of inheritance, even though it was never a formal adoption procedure. And the criteria that is set out in your outline all have to be met. One, that the foster parent died intestate, that there was a contract or an agreement to adopt, either express or implied. The foster parent must have represented to the child that the child was adopted, inducing the child to perform the duties expected, given the child's age. The child must have carried out filial obligations in the belief that he or she was adopted, and any steps taken to start an adoption had not been suspected. And this equitable adoption has a clear and convincing evidence standard, as do a lot of things in this adoption and severance of parental rights area. Okay, the section in your outline on the effect of an adoption decree is pretty straightforward. An adoption decree does exactly what it says there. It leaves the natural parent of the adopted person of all parental rights and responsibilities, terminates the relationship of parent and child, makes the natural parent and child as though they were strangers, terminates all rights of inheritance, terminates former relationships with relatives, all of those things, unless there's some specific language in the adoption decree providing for continuation of inheritance rights, or providing for visitation rights for the natural parent. And this is apparently done sometimes. If visitation rights are spelled out very specifically in adoption decree, they can exist and visitation can take place. An adoption can be appealed in the regular manner, any civil appeal, but after 1 year after an adoption decree has been entered, it cannot be questioned or set aside by anybody. This is basically just, again, another Rule 60B limitation on collateral attack. The next section is abandonment. And abandonment in Alaska requires two findings. One, conduct on the part of the parent implying abandonment, and two, destruction of the parent-child relationship as a result of that abandonment or that conduct. Delgado versus Fawcett, which is mentioned on that page, is an important case because it held that the consent of a divorced parent to a child's adoption is necessary when that parent has visitation rights, because visitation rights amount to part-time custody. Hmm. And that's the only case I know of that said that, but that could have potential implications in other areas. The burden of proof in abandonment cases is clear and convincing evidence. I don't know that you would be asked a question involving the federal statute concerning Indian adoption, the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978. And it's a really quite confusing statute to read. It governs child custody proceedings involving Indians and Native Alaskans, and it deals with foster care placement, termination of parental rights, pre-adoptive placement and adoption. In state court, as it says in your supplement, various rights are granted, including rights to notice, counsel, discovery, consent, standards of proof, etc. For example, in Alaska, in an adoption of an Alaska Native child, you have to have a whole separate relinquishment proceeding which comes before the adoption proceeding. It's not sufficient to have the mother or the father or the mother and the father consent. There has to be a whole special hearing on their giving up their parental rights. And there has to be notification to the Native corporation which the child belongs, and it's all very complicated. You probably don't have to know all the details, but if you see a question of a Native child and an adoption, you should probably say that some consideration would have to be given to this statute. Severance of parental rights. This is an area in which there is actually quite a bit of activity. Parental rights can be severed if, again, like the abandonment situation, if there is clear and convincing proof of abandonment and it has resulted in a destruction of a parent-child relationship, or there is clear and convincing evidence that for some other reason the parent is unable to control the child, take care of the child. This happens quite a bit. The state will quite frequently step into situations and petition to terminate parental rights so that they can place children that they think are in bad homes in foster care. The case of the matter of D.C., a minor, the court said clear and convincing evidence of a parent's conduct demonstrating unfitness as a standard of proof in a termination of parental rights case. Pretty much the same thing was said in the 1979 case, the matter of CLT. And more recently, in the case of Rita T. versus the state of Alaska, the court said that if a parent's rights have been terminated, but the court still has jurisdiction over the child, the parent is entitled to a review of the order of termination up until the time that the child has been adopted by somebody else. Now, the last part of your outline is, again, stuff that is pretty straightforward. Legitimacy. The parents aren't married, the child isn't legitimate, but becomes legitimate if the father subsequently marries the mother or acknowledges the child in writing, or the father is adjudged to be the father by the Superior Court. A child conceived during the course of the marriage is presumed to be the child of the husband. It doesn't have to be born, it's just supposed to be conceived. An illegitimate child is normally considered the child of both his parents. SLW versus Alaska Workers' Compensation Board is another workers' compensation case in which it was held that an unacknowledged, posthumous, illegitimate child was entitled to death benefits under the Alaska Workers' Compensation Statute, even though the law in its coverage acknowledged illegitimate children. I don't quite know what that last part means, but basically what they're saying is the comp statutes will apply to an illegitimate child born after the father dies, and he can have the benefits and receive the death benefits that a regular child would receive. This section number 4 on page 20, where it says in a paternity suit, the plaintiff's entitled is where the plaintiff is represented by the state, the indigent defendant is entitled to appointment of counsel. This is the situation that comes up when the plaintiff has been receiving welfare benefits and allows the state to go ahead and pursue the father for child support as reimbursement for the money the state has paid out in welfare. And sometimes it isn't just the simple as pursuing the father for child support, they have to first establish that he's the father. And he's, of course, saying, I'm not the father, I'm not the father. And the person in that situation is entitled to counsel, he's indigent. Majority age, majority is 18. You arrive at the age of majority when you're married, unless you're under the marriageable age of consent, in which case you reach majority upon reaching the marriageable age of consent. The fact that a child is under
would
the age...
Would you put that by again? I read it over several times.
Yeah. Okay.
It says you're not majority until you're 18, unless you're married, in which case you're not majority until you're 18.
Right.
I think in this case 18 is wrong. I think what that means that is that if you marry, which is 16, then you reach the age of majority. Or if you're married before then, when you turn 16. Does that make sense? Yeah, I think that's what it should be. The final thing says when the child is below the age of majority, that doesn't mean that he's incompetent in all matters. It just means that above the age of majority, he is competent in all matters, which is something that probably everybody knows anyway. The section on torts is... again, pretty straightforward. You've probably studied in your tort lecture the tort immunity between parent and child has been abolished, except where the child is suing the parent for some kind of negligent exercise of parental authority, like failing to house them or educate them or clothe them or something like that, in which case the child can't maintain suit against the parent. Interspousal actions for negligent torts can be maintained while the parties are married in Alaska. The section on consortium we may have already studied in torts. The basis for recovery for loss of consortium is injury to the conjugal relationship, not loss of services. A consortium claim has to be joined with the main personal injury claim that can't be filed later. And it belongs, or both the husband and the wife have the right to sue for loss of consortium. It cannot bring a loss of consortium claim against a spouse's employer because of the exclusive remedy provisions of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Statute. Going on to the section on real property and contracts. It says here that a deed from a husband to himself and his wife is tenants by the entirety can be purely voluntary and doesn't have to be supported by consideration. A conveyance of land to any two or more persons is deemed to create a tenancy in common. In Alaska, we don't have any joint tenancy. Tenancy by the entirety is like joint tenancy, but unless you marry and able to enjoy the benefits of tenancy by the entirety, there's no joint tenancy. You have to be a tenant in common. And we have a statute that says that somewhere, I think in Title 34, says about two-line statute that says there's no joint tenancy in Alaska. If a husband and wife continue to hold property jointly after they get divorced, and sometimes people do this because they have a lot of property, they don't want to sell it, the market isn't good, they don't want a lot of capital gains at one time, they hold that property as tenants in common once the divorce is final, even though they held it as tenants by the entirety before they got a divorce. One spouse's truly separate property cannot be reached for the debts of another spouse. The section on agency says that the husband, wife...
Two questions on tenancy by the entirety.
Uh-huh.
In creating tenancy by the entirety, it just says to A and B, you have to be husband and wife. Is that creating tenancy by the entirety, or does it have to say A and B as husband and wife?
As opposed to A and B, who
yes,
happen
so it's
to
just
be?
A and B happen to be husband and wife.
And
is that tenancy in common or tenancy by the entirety?
I think that is presumed to create tenancy by the entirety if they are married.
Okay.
But it's always a good idea if you're drafting these things to put in a tenancy by the entirety. The section on agency. The husband-wife relationship doesn't make the people each other's agents. This is a situation that does quite often arise in divorces where one party gets mad and says, or doesn't say anything, runs out and lists the house with a real estate broker, and the other party doesn't know, doesn't sign a listing agreement. The broker goes out and finds the buyer. The buyer falls in love with the house, and the wife won't go along. She says, no, I didn't sign a listing agreement. I'm going to live in this house for the next 10 years. And then the spouse who listed the house, and I had this happen to somebody on the other side of one of my cases, can be sued both by the broker for his commission and by the buyer for the failure of the sale to occur. So, something to remember. Then there's this little section on the state that says the statutes of Alaska relating to property rights of married women have abolished the common law unity of husband and wife. And separate property can't be reached for the debt of the other spouse. And that pretty much takes us through the outline. There's just one other thing that I wanted to mention before we finish.
I have one question on tenancy by the entirety.
Okay.
Tenancy by the entirety in common law has some fairly obnoxious aspects in that the husband had practically total dominion over the property.
Right.
Have those been abolished in the last year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The final thing that I wanted to mention, and again, I don't know if it's something that will be on your exam, is the domestic violence statute, which is at AS 955-600. And this is new legislation. It's about 18 months old. If you have time, it might be wise to glance over it. It's kind of unique. It's a do-it-yourself procedure providing for injunctive relief in cases of domestic violence. It's not limited to spouses. It's available to people who are living with people, any kind of domestic violence. And basically, what the person does is they go down to the court, they fill out a set of forms, they're taken to see a judge, and they, if the judge grants the petitioner, given an ex parte order, and a hearing in 10 days, at which time the other side has been notified and can appear for the hearing and contest it. And if the petitioner is successful, they will get a preliminary injunction that lasts 45 days. The court can do quite a lot under the statute. It can restrain the respondent from subjecting the petitioner to domestic violence. It can tell the respondent to get out of the home. It can tell the respondent not to communicate directly or indirectly with the petitioner. It can tell the respondent to pay support for the petitioner or for a minor child in care of the petitioner if there's an independent legal obligation of the respondent to support the petitioner or the child. I had a case in which my client was a man, and he had been married to this woman and then divorced. Married for a couple of months and then divorced for about a year, and then they sort of got back together, but they were drinking a lot and fighting a lot. But they had the same last name. She went into court and got one of the domestic violence petitions and told the judge how much money he made. He was a construction foreman, so he made quite a bit of money. And so she got an award of alimony under the domestic violence statute, even though she wasn't married to the guy any longer and he had no legal obligation to be providing it. It got straightened out a week later, but you can achieve quite a lot with these things.
Does this have a citation?
Yes, 955 defendant. It's an assembly supplement section of the statute. And it's going to award temporary custody. So it's really quite all-encompassing. And the only thing is that the most it lasts 45 days, although you can petition to have it extended. And I think it's been giving the court system quite a few headaches. So that, I think, is everything that I can think of that you need to know for the exam. So good luck with it.
Thank you.
On that, I said, I hate your thing. Yeah, buddy.
And so what we do is, under the concept of dependent relative revocation, we disregard the revocation. Now, that analysis doesn't work when the handwriting is less. You got a $10,000 gift to Aunt Nellie. It's lined out. Written in there is $5,000. Now, can the court say, look, if the testator had known that the $5,000 were going to be no good, he would just as soon have had Nellie get the $10,000. The court won't make that assumption. The court's making the assumption, listen, for some reason or another, he does not want to give Nellie $10,000. He wants to give her a lesser sum. He can't give her the lesser sum because the lesser sum is not validated according to the formalities of the statute of wills. The larger sum is revoked. The lesser sum is no good. And Nellie gets nothing. And that's how revocation by interlineation, as coupled with dependent relative revocation, works. It's a deep, heavy morass of a subject. But you can read the outline. You can annotate that little picture diagram there, and you've got all the law you need to know about that problem, except the problem of Probate Code 350, which drives me nuts every time I think about it, all right? Because it really adds a totally unnecessary complication. But if we didn't have complicated problems, we wouldn't need 60,000 lawyers in the state of California now, would we? So maybe we ought to be happy that there are these complications in the law. Okay, caveat probate code section 350, anytime you're dealing with revocation by interlineation, all right? What are we dealing with? We're dealing with class drill 12, all right? Class drill 12. Look at what happens. What happens is that you've got the death of our particular character here. We've got the death at this point in time, all right? Now, what happens is that we discover, when we get ready to probate his will, that his will is lost or destroyed. Okay? Now, if it were destroyed, as we're going to have the problem in dependent relative revocation, if it was destroyed before he died at point X, if you're dealing with a situation of a lost or destroyed will before death, you got a big problem. Because Probate Code 350 will not allow you to prove up a copy of that will, even though you got 20 bishops to testify to the validity of that copy is verbatim what the destroyed will is. You cannot prove up that copy unless what? Unless you can show that the will was destroyed by fraud or by a public calamity. All right. Now that is to be definitely distinguished from the situation where you discover, hey, look, the will has been destroyed. I'm sorry, it's been lost. It's been burned up. But it was lost at point Y, after the testator died. Under Probate Code 350, when the will is destroyed after the testator dies, as long as you have two credible witnesses to testify that the copy you're presenting is a valid copy, you can put that copy into the evidence. Now, we can illustrate it by a little hypo that was beginning to get passe until Norman Lear started subscription TV and put the Towering Inferno back on. All right? Let's take a look at a little situation here. That little funny little diagram there is what? That's a high-rise office building, all right? And there's a fire that starts down below, all right? Now, what happens is the testator's lawyer is at floor 100. That's where the will is. The testator is on floor 90, let's say, all right? The fire burns up. Now, what happens to the testator? He becomes an enchilada. He's dead, all right? The fire goes up to will, to the will on floor 100 and is destroyed. We got any problem in Probate Code 350? Uh-uh. Why? Because the will is destroyed after the testator died. We got two witnesses that can come in with a copy to prove up this is the copy. It's admitted. All right? Well, what happens if we work the other way? What happens if the testator is not on floor 90, the testator is on floor 110? Okay? And now what happens? The fire comes up. It destroys the will on floor 100 before it turns the testator into our proverbial enchilada. So the will is destroyed before death. Can we prove up a copy? Sure, why? What's the fire? The fire is a public calamity. If the will is destroyed before death in a public calamity, Probate Code 350 still allows us to prove it up. All right. Now what if the fire has started? Huh? And the testator says, son of a bitch, I got to change my will. And he writes out a new will. He doesn't know about holographic will, so he doesn't sign it. He's waiting to get two witnesses. It's sitting there on his desk. All right? What happens? He runs down to floor 100, rips up will number one, destroys it by physical act, gets in the elevator to go up to floor 110. The elevators are gone. He's fried. There's no execution of the second will. Hey, what can we do now? Why did he revoke the first will? He revoked the first will because he thought he was going to make it back up there to execute that second will. He didn't. If he had known that he was not going to make it up there to execute that second will, he never would have destroyed the first will. In most jurisdictions, that's a classic case to apply the concept of dependent relative revocation. In California, it's a classic case to apply the concept of dependent relative revocation. Why? Why was will one revoked? Because he thought will two was going to be valid. Will two wasn't valid. As long as the provisions are generally consistent, you can disregard the revocation of the first will. Super. We disregard the revocation of will one. Now we are faced with what problem in California? How do we admit a copy? Unless we can convince the court that because will number one was destroyed before his death as the result of a public calamity, we don't get the copy in. We don't get the copy in. Probate Code 350 is a major block to proving up cases under dependent relative revocation. Now I got to tell you this. Of recent times, the bar examiners, when they put this thing together originally, I think, didn't really understand what they'd done by adding Probate Code 350, because they'd have all these detailed dependent relative revocation problems, and the goddamn will would be destroyed, And the analysis would be, hey, listen, even though dependent relative revocation works perfectly, probate code 350 doesn't allow you to prove up the copy. So what have they done of recent? Of recent times, they have gone to the basic situation of having a valid will, having that valid will revoked, having that valid will revoked by physical act. How do they get around probate code 350? The physical act is induced by what? You guessed it, fraud. Okay? When you can prove dependent relative revocation, when you can prove that that revocation was induced by fraud, what happens? DR, dependent relative revocation, lets you have that first will back in effect. How do you prove it up? Probate code 350, as long as you've got a good copy and two credible witnesses, allows you to prove up that will even though it was destroyed before death because it was destroyed by fraud. And that's the way validity and revocation work. It is a son of a bitch, huh? I mean, there are a lot of rules there. Wills is a rule-oriented course. And when I was first given the assignment to do this, I said to myself, my God, it's impossible. It's impossible. But you take a look at it, and you study the past questions, and you watch the way they fit together, and there is a flow. Now, it is April 19th, 1980. You had a long time between now and the last week in July. Now, what happens is that for those people who don't see this tape until the last week of the course, it usually gives them a big laugh because they got about 10 days to soak this stuff up. I tell you, people on the tape, even though you only got 10 days, if you'll take the approach and wrestle with it for several hours and work to the hypotheticals, it works. And before I let you go for lunch, I'm going to show you how it works in one of the easier questions. Let's take a look at hypothetical number one. It's on the back side of revocation. I wanted to finish up because the name of this game is confidence, all right? You've got to have confidence. Now let's take a look at this question. It was given in 1979, all right? It's one of the easier questions. That's why I give it to you just before the lunch break, all right? Well, we finish today, I'll give you the tougher ones. Tessier Widow died leaving a two-page handwritten will having two dispository clauses. Clause 1 provided for a bequest of $10,000 to each of my children, Ann, Brad, and Charlie. Clause 2 provided that all of Tessie's stocks and bonds be given to Brad to be used as we have agreed. Tessie's home and her personal effects, together worth $60,000, were not disposed of by the will. Tessie had signed her name on the bottom of page 1 of the will. Page 2 contained only the date in her handwriting and Brad's signature as a witness. When the will was offered for probate, several lines had been drawn through Ann's name in Clause 1, but the will was otherwise not altered. Brad is prepared to testify that several months after signing the will, Tessie, in his presence, drew lines through Ann's name, and Tessie told him she wanted to disinherit Ann. Well, there's our old friend, disinheritance by fiat. Brad is also prepared to testify that he had agreed with Tessie to use the income from the stocks and bonds for Charlie, but that the stocks and bonds were to be Brad's after Charlie's death. Charlie died several months before Tessie, leaving no spouse or descendants. The estate includes, in addition to Tessie's home and personal effects, $10,000 cash in stocks and bonds worth $70,000. Assume the applicable statutory provisions are the same as the comparable provisions of the California Probate Code. Dead giveaway that it's a wills question. That's the only way that they can tell you that it's a wills question. The only other way is you've got to be careful, and we'll work on this in crossover technique. In community property, we can get a wills issue. Why? Because community property says answer according to California law. What's California law include? The California Probate Code. All right? Two, if the will is valid, how should the estate be distributed? Discuss. Now, this is one of the few instances. Most of my approaches and my mind techniques are flexible. They have their ability to be changed by you. The approach in wills can be changed. I mean, you can add, you can subtract, you can redraw the diagrams. If I get you to do that, boy, I have really accomplished my mission, which is to show you how to learn. You get involved with the subject. Now, the method, however, for answering a wills question, I want to tell you, after doing this for 15 years, you look at every single question that comes down, there is no way, as I'm going to say, from time to time, throughout this course, there is no way to keep these facts straight in your head unless you happen to be the clone of Justice Cardozo. There is no way to keep these facts straight without a diagram. And in Wills, what you do is on the right-hand side of the page, you lay out your family tree. You put the testator in his pine box. Testator was Tessie. She had a husband. He's croaked. You can draw an X through H. They had kids, A, B, and C. You take a look at the facts. You draw a cross through C. C's not around. C's dead. All right. On the right-hand side, you draw the family tree. Why? Because for the last 5 years, every bloody California wills question has involved problems of intestacy. And the only way you're going to be able to visualize who takes the intestate share is to have the family tree. Okay? Now, what do? On the left-hand side, you then chart out the instruments and events. This is an easy question. Why? There's only one will. There's only one document, a holographic will, $10,000 to each of A, B, and C, stocks and bonds to B, home and personal effects not disposed of. Okay, what do? You test the problem for validity, revocation, and what we're going to do this afternoon, distribution, and then you look for intestacy. Okay, what about validity? Capacity, you got any problems with capacity? This lady seemed to be of the right age. She'd had kids, she'd got to be over 18. There was no problem with mental delusion, no problem with mental deficiency. How about intent? We got no problem with capacity, intent, they're all okay. This is how you run it through your mind. This is the mental checklist. If you want, you can write it out on your scratch paper. But you'll start out your answer. The holographic document seems to be okay as far as capacity and intent are concerned. However, the major problem here is whether or not the formalities of the statute of wills have been met. This does not qualify as an attested will because the number of witnesses is not enough. There's only one witness in probate code 50. You don't have to know the probate code section. All you got to know is you need two witnesses. There are not two witnesses, okay? Now, however, what about probate code 53, the holographic will? Hey, this instrument is dated. It's signed. It's all in the testator's handwriting. Oops. What's on the second page? The witness's signature. What's the problem? The problem is the document is not all in the testator's handwriting. There is something else there. And what do you have to wrestle with? You have to wrestle with the law fork. Is this jurisdiction going to use the surplusage test? If it does, the witness's signature is pure surplusage and the document will stand. Or is it going to use the intent to incorporate test? If it uses the intent to incorporate, testee clearly asked this guy to sign, therefore she clearly intended to incorporate his signature, even though it's mere surplusage, the document fails. That's the concept of forking. You take the basic issue both ways in terms of validity of the will. And what do? In terms of distribution of the estate? You got two problems. Either A, the will is valid, or it is invalid. If the will is valid, what happens? How about Anne? Her testate gift was revoked. But hey, look, what's the problem? She's not otherwise taken care of. You go through your whole will of revocation. What happens? You got a kid in there. There's no provision there for Anne anymore. Therefore, she can step up and take her intestate share unless you want to construe, unless what? Unless you want to construe the lining out as an indication that Anne was to take nothing. Even if you do, however, what happens? Brad's gift is okay. He gets his $10,000, but there's no residuary clause. What happens to the balance of the property? It goes intestate. And how much does Anne get? And I want to show you something here. When I get up and I do these presentations, sometimes people say that he is an egomaniac. All right? Now, let me tell you, there's a difference between having a large ego, which lawyers need, and being sick. All right? difference is the large egomaniac who is psychotic doesn't admit errors. I want to show you. This was a true error on my part because I didn't follow my own drill when I made out this outline. If I wanted to, I could tell you that the intestate share is a typo when it says one-third. You want to know the real truth? The real truth is that when I put this damn diagram together, I forgot to follow my own drill to X out C. And when you X out C, what happens? Then you clearly see that there are only two intestate heirs, A and B. And they split the intestate share 50-50. But wait a minute, what about that evidence that N was to take nothing? What is that? That's an attempt to disinherit by fiat. The only way you can cut somebody out of their intestate share is to provide a valid alternative scheme, and that hasn't been done here. The only thing that's valid under this will, if anything, is the gift to Brad, and everything else passes intestate. Who are the intestate heirs? Ann and Brad. No disinheritance by fiat. Brad, what are the problems there? He takes his testate gift, a little teaser for tomorrow, if you can stand this high pressure, if not, wait for the tape. The gift to Brad is what we call a semi-secret trust. What happens is Brad wants to come in and prove up these details. Will he be allowed to? Quick preview, courts are split. Some courts say yeah, some courts say no. We'll talk about that in the first hour of tomorrow morning, all right? How about the intestate share? Again, he takes a half. He takes a half because he's one of the two intestate shares. What about Charlie? Charlie's dead. Therefore, Charlie, as we're going to see this afternoon, his gift is lapsed. Now, if Charlie, again, little preview for this afternoon, if Charlie had left lineal heirs, then his lineals would step up under probate code 93 and take his interest. They would take his interest. They'd take it under probate code 93. They'd also take it under the laws of intestate succession, come to think of it, because they would be the intestate heirs. But he didn't leave anybody, and as a consequence, he takes nothing. What happens if the will is not valid? If the will is not valid, then what happens is it just the whole thing passes intestate. A half to Ann, a half to Brad. Okay. What are we going to do now? It is 10 minutes to 1 by my watch. Let's try and take a short lunch and take up again at 20 minutes to 2, huh? Let's take up again at 20 minutes to 2 at 1:40, and we ought to be out of here by around 3 o'clock is what I'd guess, okay?